This is The Health Show, a presentation of National Productions.
Okay, stop me if you've heard about this one. Tuberous sclerosis. Yep, I don't see too many people holding up stop signs. Only a few thousand people in the U.S. are living with this condition, and they know all too well the complications and endless medical procedures it brings along.
It's the leading genetic cause of epilepsy and autism.
On today's Health Show, we'll learn about tuberous sclerosis.
Also, in our earliest school biology classes, we learned about the process of cell division. But do you know exactly how that happens? For a long time, neither did anyone else, until a pioneering doctor and his microscope found the answer. We'll hear his story. I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Health Show. There's a good chance this segment is going to surprise you. We're going to talk about tuberous sclerosis. Most of you will be surprised because we expect you've never heard of it before. But a few will be surprised because they're one of the 60,000 or so who live with the condition and probably have never heard those words spoken outside their doctor's office. We have a pair of experts here today to help us learn about tuberous sclerosis. Kari Luther-Rosbeck is the president and CEO of the Tuberous Sclerosis Alliance. And Dr. Steve Robards is the chief scientific officer at the Alliance. And Kari, I'll start with you. Let's go through the basics. Just what is tuberous sclerosis?
Tuberous sclerosis complex is a genetic disorder that causes tumor growth throughout the body, the brain, heart, kidney, liver, lungs, skin. It's the leading genetic cause of epilepsy and a leading genetic cause of autism.
Now, when people hear the word tumors, they immediately think, well, it's cancer, but these are not cancerous tumors, correct?
Correct. They're benign tumors, but we don't think that there's anything benign about tuberous sclerosis complex. Certainly, tumors in the brain can lead to seizures or intractable seizures. Tumors in the kidneys can lead to renal failure. So though they're benign tumors, they certainly can impact somebody's life in a very dramatic way.
Last year, we did a segment on von Hippel-Lindau disease, and this sounds very similar to that. In doing a little research, I see that they're similar conditions with different genetic pathways, I guess.
That's right. And we're actually, I've had conversations with individuals at the VHL organization to think about ways that we might be able to work together. You're right, the diseases are related. We want to understand more about how the pathways in the cell that are dysregulated in the two diseases, how they interact and how they overlap, because clearly there's some similarity. We think we can learn from each other. So research in one is likely to benefit research in the other in many cases.
As we said, these tumors are non-cancerous, but, you know, tumors anywhere in the body are going to cause some problems eventually, especially if they get big enough. Where is it most likely to cause a problem?
Right. It depends on the age. So at the youngest age, it could be in the heart where the rhabdomyomas grow. If they are so large that they could affect cardiac function, that's, fortunately, it's relatively rare. A more common but still relatively rare occurrence is to have tumors in the brain and what we call subependymal giant cell astrocytomas, or SEGAs for short, can grow in the brain in a region that, if they grow large enough or in the right spot, they can disrupt the flow of cerebrospinal fluid. That's the fluid that bathes the brain and the spinal cord. And if the flow of that fluid is blocked, the individual can develop increased pressure within the brain, which can cause pain, damage, and death if untreated. The other key places are the lung, where cysts can grow throughout the lung. It's not one tumor, but rather a dysregulated growth pattern throughout the lung where cysts can form that cause a disease abbreviated as LAM, L-A-M. Which affects primarily women and can occur in the absence of tuberous sclerosis complex or with tuberous sclerosis complex, and can lead to problems breathing, and some women are faced with lung transplant. And then the third is the kidney, where angiomyolipomas or AMLs can grow, and particularly if they're not being monitored. So I think the real risk here is somebody who's not been diagnosed with TSC or who is not being followed closely and could have a tumor growing in their kidney that can get so large or be in the wrong place that it leads to bleeding or to impaired function of the kidney, in which case again, they can lose the kidney, and then they're left with one, and the tumors could occur in the other kidney as well, and again, they're back on a transplant list. So those three areas, the brain, the lung, and the kidney, are the key places that we look out for tumor growth.
Is this something where it could affect the optic nerve also?
Theoretically, it could impact the optic nerve, depending on where it grows. And there's a subset of individuals who actually have tumors that grow within the retina as well. So that's another place, again, less common. But as I think you've heard from Kari, everybody's different. And that's really where the word complex comes from in tuberous sclerosis complex, is how complex this disease is in terms of a number of different components and manifestations and a variety among how it affects individuals.
Our families often describe tuberous sclerosis complex as going through a minefield blindfolded, because you never know when another symptom will appear.
Kari, well, let's talk about getting awareness of this disease out there. I mean, tuberous sclerosis does not exactly roll off the tongue. It's not something we've heard of a lot. Many people are probably hearing about it for the first time right now. Is this something where the public needs to be informed, or do doctors need to be informed to just, you know, remember to look for it?
Absolutely. We truly believe that TSC could be misdiagnosed or undiagnosed. And it's very important, particularly in infancy, and Steve can elaborate on this, that individuals be diagnosed quickly with tuberous sclerosis, so that if they're having seizures, infantile spasms in particular, that treatment is offered as quickly as possible. We know that treatment that happens immediately could lead to improved quality of life later on.
Right. A lot of that is awareness and really getting it out there to the frontline physicians and the pediatric neurologists who are going to be referred with these cases, and just to remind them, because it's a relatively rare disease, to remind them to always consider this as a diagnosis that they should rule out. Of course, most people won't have this disease, but if they see an infant that has infantile spasms, they should definitely consider TSC as a diagnosis. The same with rhabdomyomas in the heart, because the way that those problems may be treated in someone with TSC might be different in the way you treat them if they don't have TSC. So it's important to get that diagnosis right and get it early.
What about the genetic component of this disease? How likely is a child to have it if a parent has it?
Right. If a parent has it, then the chance of a child, and assuming the other parent doesn't, the chance of a child inheriting that is 50-50. Because it's a dominant disease, that means the individual who has two copies of every chromosome only needs one copy with that mutation to inherit TSC. And so it's actually a 50-50 chance.
But not all people who have it do have parents who have it. So what was it, like one-third it's genetic and two-third is just spontaneous?
Right. And that's just because of the spontaneous mutation rate of the genes, of the TSC1 and TSC2 genes. Mutations can occur. You know, the baby is able to develop in the womb. There may be problems during development, such as the formation of rhabdomyomas, and the organization of the brain is probably affected, which is what could lead to that susceptibility to seizures and autism, etc. But the baby is alive and relatively healthy, even though that mutation has occurred spontaneously. And so, right, about two-thirds of cases are explained by that, because it's not inherited from the parents.
Kari, what is the Alliance doing to get the word out?
We have an incredible social network. We have 32 volunteer branches of our organization across the country called Community Alliances. And in those communities, they, of course, are spreading the word with their local news media. They're holding educational meetings. They try to educate their local physicians. And they hold incredible community fundraisers, which help spread the word even further. So we're very proud of our efforts. Also today, we are having a congressional briefing on Capitol Hill to continue to educate our legislators of the importance of federally funded tuberous sclerosis complex research.
Beyond education, what other types of support services are being offered for people who have this?
So we have educational meetings. We have information on our website. We have ongoing clinical trials. We offer support for families whose children are going through the school system and assistance with their individual education plans. We attend association meetings where we try to educate medical professionals, and of course our outreach to the media.
And what about the clinical trials? Tell us what you're actually looking to gain from those.
Steve, would you like to take that one? Because I know that we, I can give you the overview. Our whole mission as an organization is to improve the lives of those affected while ultimately finding a cure for tuberous sclerosis. Clinical trials certainly are leading us to better treatments for the different manifestations of tuberous sclerosis. And Steve can give you an overview of a couple of those clinical trials and what we're looking for.
Right. In a general sense, the clinical trials are aimed to develop new treatments that are going to improve the health and the quality of life of individuals with TSC. A couple of examples of successful trials have been the use of mTOR inhibitors to shrink and halt the growth of the sagas that I talked about earlier in the brain. And now there's a drug approved for that indication in TSC. And just about 3 weeks ago, the same drug was approved for the treatment of the renal tumors, the angiomyolipomas, in individuals with TSC. So trials have shown a real benefit of this medicine on the progression of the disease in individuals, and that's what we're shooting for. Then we have ongoing clinical trials, one currently in Children's Hospital Boston and Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center, looking at effects of a drug on neurocognition. So we hope to improve, you know, see if that drug is improving the quality of life, the ability of the individuals who are taking that drug to think and reason and behave more normally, more the way they would like to than they can without. And then another trial that's ready to begin very soon is one of topical application of a drug to the facial angiofibromas or the tumors that are on the face. While not life-threatening, that's a major quality of life issue, especially because they tend to come on in the teenage years, and we know that's about the worst time for young adults to experience a disfiguring type of disease, and so that's a major quality of life issue. And so there are clinicians and scientists working on ways to address that as well.
Are the tumors right now, how are they being treated? Do you just have to go in and get them if they're causing trouble, and is that even possible with some of them?
It is possible with many of them, and it depends on how many there are and where they're located. So if the tumor can be removed, even from the brain, and that's a reasonably common surgery in TSC, if the tumor can be removed from the brain, that's ideal because then it won't grow back. Now, that doesn't mean that a new one couldn't start, but at least the one that is there can be removed. It's more of a problem to do surgery if there are many different tumors. Obviously, you don't want to cut up the brain in too many ways, be too aggressive with it, or if they're located on both sides of the brain where, again, it's hard to get to. It would be multiple surgeries, and it's just not realistic, and that's where the power of the drugs comes in to help halt the growth. Same with the kidney. You know, if the tumor can be removed, great. Certainly, if it can be removed while maintaining most of the kidney's function, that's the ideal state. And then on the skin, there have been treatments over the last few years of using laser treatment to remove the tumors on the face. But again, much less invasive if we can find a drug that's both going to be safe and effective at those tumors.
Kari Luther-Rosbeck is the president and CEO, and Dr. Steve Robards is the chief scientific officer at the Tuberous Sclerosis Alliance. You can learn more at their website, tsalliance.org.
Still to come, the process of cell division is essential to all living things. We'll learn about the man who discovered just how that happens next on The Health Show.
You can find The Health Show anytime online at healthshow.org. Search the archive and listen to whole programs you may have missed or would like to hear again. Even subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org. You can also follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow.
You can start your own Health Show archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for Health Show number 1269.
This is The Health Show. I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs. Dividing cells are what make up all life. The idea of cell division was first published in 1855, but for nearly a century, scientists debated how. There were theories, but researchers struggled to prove just what force was behind this simple yet immensely complex function of life. It took a dedicated scientist and the microscope he invented to uncover the mystery. Sarah Roberson brings us that story.
Every once in a blue moon, someone comes along who changes the world.
Yes, my name is Shinya Inoue.
Dr. Shinya Inoue is one of those people. On the street, he's not famous, but in the cell biology community, the 91-year-old Dr. Inoue is a legend. Inoue is a soft-spoken Japanese biologist. He invented a way of looking at live cells that revolutionized our understanding of how molecular life works. And he did it despite war.
You could hear them dropping the incendiary bombs. They sounded like a huge rain or something coming down.
In World War II, the Japanese were pounded with fire air raids and atomic bombs. The scale of damage was something the world had never seen. Inoue was a young scientist during the war. He says even though war is going on, one still has to live. And science was Inoue's life. His legacy is a source of inspiration for other scientists. Diana Kenny is a science writer at the Marine Biological Laboratory in Woods Hole, Massachusetts.
Shinya Inoue recognized that, yes, war is happening, but that doesn't mean science has to stop and inquiry has to stop. Unfortunately, war often does disrupt science, but they didn't see any reason for it to.
During the war, Inoue's mentor, Dr. Kitsuma Dan, gave him a challenge almost as old as cell biology itself. Why and how does a cell divide? In the 1940s, no one could see inside a live cell to see exactly what was pulling the chromosomes apart. Microscope images of live cells looked like fuzzy home movies, and the still snapshots of a dead cell were much clearer. But studying dead or fixed cells was sort of a problem, Inoue thought, when what you're trying to see is life. He was challenged to invent his own microscope, to see inside a live cell, to provide proof of the mechanism responsible for cell division, the mitotic spindle.
A scientist is very lucky if they find a mentor who gives them one of the biggest questions in the field and says, go for it.
Inoue barely missed a beat. Only 2 years after the end of World War II, in 1947, amongst the unthinkable conditions of Japan, Inoue completed his task.
So I made my own porosity microscope and I went around the lab and found some old discarded machine gun base, which I used to support everything.
In papers documenting the process, he labeled the sketches of his invention the Shinyascope.
Okay, so here it is. So this is the first microscope he built. He built this by assembling parts from, he started with a cast-off base of a machine gun and then started adding, here's a tea can. Is the polarizer, you know, different parts of the microscope, and it's all secured on with twine on a machine gun base. So this is the kind of microscope you build during wartime.
With the microscope, he could see what he called the dark mystery. He could see the chromosomes being pulled apart by the spindle. But the images weren't clear enough. He wanted irrefutable images.
But none of them came anywhere close to the kind of image I started getting at Princeton.
Because of his early success, Dr. Inoue was accepted to Princeton to get his PhD. In the early 1950s, he recreated his polarizing light microscope. Simply put, it uses the type of light that comes through your sunglasses. It's pretty complex, but what you need to know is that with this microscope, he was finally able to see straight into dividing cells with precision and clarity. Dr. Inoue was the first scientist to capture indisputable proof of what pulls chromosomes apart and makes a cell divide. But when he finally saw this cellular mystery at work, Diana Kenny says the mystery didn't get solved, it only got bigger.
I mean, what he thought he could see with a polarized light microscope was something that didn't really make any sense to most people. People have thought of the spindle as something like a muscle. So how could a muscle disappear and then return? They thought of it as something in the cell that acted like a muscle. to pull the chromosomes apart. But what he was really seeing was a structure it's very dynamic and it's unstable.
So he introduced this special idea into cell biology.
Dr. Gary Borsi is the director of the Marine Biological Laboratory.
That structures, as you see them, are not to be taken simply as static entities that are there for the life of the cell. Once you see a structure, like if you look around this room, there's a chair. And you can see that chair, and we expect the chair to remain there, not only for the rest of this conversation, but for tomorrow and the next day. You don't expect it to be taken apart into the spindles and the seat and so forth, the legs, and then to be reassembled into that the next day. But in fact, in the cell, when you look at the equivalent of a chair, the next day, it's been completely disassembled and reassembled. In fact, it's being disassembled and reassembled generally on a time scale of seconds or minutes.
And he persisted with it. And he turned out to be right. I mean, nobody would say that for another 20, 30 years, but Shinya was right.
And that insight, of course, it's been expanded now through many other kinds of studies, but that insight is now a paradigm that governs the way we look at molecular processes in cells today.
Scientists don't set out to make a revolution. They set out to answer a question that is critical and important. But in searching for the answer to how cells divide, Dr. Inoue opened a window into the instability of life. This had immeasurable consequences for the world of cell biology, the effects of which are still felt in our lives today. New medicines for cancer add months or years onto people's lives, and the science behind those medicines is a continuation of the research Inoue pioneered. Dr. Inoue says he builds microscopes to study healthy cells so we can learn what happens when they go wrong.
So in order to understand what's going on in life and to explain those things, which, because we're humans, we're curious, we keep on probing further and further into what's going on. And then on the other hand, because there's a good hope that by studying and understanding what goes wrong with these events, we could understand disease processes and hopefully cure them.
At 91 years old, Dr. Inoue is feeling the fragility of life. Most tragically, his eyes are going, a true loss for a man whose legacy is what he was able to see. But in the science community, he's still known as an unstoppable force. He's revered by many as a man who gave science new eyes. Reporting from Woods Hole, I'm Sarah Robertson.
That's all the time we have for this week's Health Show. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at healthshow.org. You can explore the archive for any programs you might have missed or would like to hear again. You can also subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org.
Want more? Then follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is letters@healthshow.org.
I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
Stay healthy and be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Health Show.
Dr. Nina Sachs is a practicing member of the American College of Gastroenterology. Bob Barrett is producer of The Health Show. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Health Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.